All right, with us on our studio line is Jetsunma Tenzin Pamo, a Buddhist nun. She is affiliated with the Dongyu Gatsa Ling Nunnery.
You're getting better and better, Alan.
Thank you, dear.
Practice makes perfect. There we go.
I have a feeling I may have been somewhere in a monastery in prior lives myself, but I haven't touched into that directly. Not that it's important, but you know, I so relate to the Buddha and the teaching of the Buddha that has come through. At least the Buddha that most people remember or has been written about, and maybe this is a point of discussion. You spoke of crying tears of devotion to the Buddha and wanting to be a bodhisattva early on, again, during your younger days as a teenager or woman. What was that yearning? Because, I mean, I can relate to it. I know when I read what was written about, the Buddha didn't write. He was an oral teacher, storyteller. And there's other Buddhas too. I mean, we're talking about Gautama Buddha, right?
Yes.
As the Buddha that most people relate to. What was it? What brought those tears?
I mean, for me, the thing was that at the beginning, I was introduced to the Theravadin form of Buddhism, which is extant nowadays in Sri Lanka and Thailand and Burma and so forth. And there, the aim of everyone's practice is to become what is called an arhat, which means someone who has completely uprooted the negative emotions of their anger, attachment, and self-delusion, and have entered nirvana. And, I mean, good as this was, to my mind, it disturbed me. I didn't want to be an arhat. It sounded somehow sort of selfish, and I felt there was something missing. And it took quite some time before I heard about the bodhisattvas, those who are aspiring to enlightenment or Buddhahood, not for themselves, but in order to be able to liberate all other beings. So the focus of their attention, although it is to purifying and enlightening themselves, it's purely in order to be able to benefit others. Like if one practices to be a doctor, you could do that so that you'll earn lots of money and be very well respected in the community, and you know it will enhance your own sense of being somebody special. Or you could do it out of compassion, seeing that there's so much suffering in the world, and therefore you want to become a doctor in order to benefit as many beings as possible. So it's a very different motivation.
This is very key here to tie into the last, the end of our conversation. We're going to talk about a meaningful life. Can we make this assertion that most meaningful life has to be involved with some form of service to others, or it's not meaningful?
I think so. I think one of the problems nowadays is that for so many people, mistaking, you know, pleasure for happiness, they, you know, there's always this thought still that a bigger house or a bigger car or a better relationship will bring everlasting joy and happiness. And of course it doesn't. And then people are disappointed. And their life after a while, when they've gained everything they've dreamed of and they're still not happy, it's the kind of futility. You know, wherein does happiness lie?
That's a good question. Wherein does happiness lie?
Well, happiness lies within, isn't it? I mean, and the idea that maybe one's own happiness in so many ways depends on bringing happiness to others, then it completely changes the emphasis, doesn't it?
Yes. Let's talk about this, you know, going from meaningful to happiness and what it is and what one, quote, needs, what one needs or perceive they need and what they really need for happiness. Earlier on in our conversation, you talked about a book that you were reading and your first touch into Buddhism, which was The Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. That four, the dissertation of the Buddha on the Four Noble Truths is about ending pain and suffering.
Exactly. This was always the focus point of the Buddha. And I mean, we must remember he was a prince, you know, and he had every worldly pleasure you could imagine. Mm-hmm. And yet that was not meaningful, which was why he left the palace.
Yeah. And he spent a number...
So he knew what he was talking about.
Well, he developed the Four Noble Truths, you know, after leaving the palace, right? I mean...
Yeah, well, after his enlightenment.
Yeah. He was on the road for a while. He tried many things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great story, and that's... You know, when you read it, you said to your mother, I'm a Buddhist, I believe, right?
Mm.
And when I read it, although it might have been in a somewhat fictionalized version because it was Siddhartha, the book.
Oh, right.
But very well written by, I forget who the author.
Yes, Hesse.
Hermann Hesse, right.
Mm.
And then, of course, that led me into Buddhism in a much deeper way.
But it led many thousands and thousands of people, I think, especially in the early days before Buddhism was, you know, something you could buy in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. And... would you talk about the Four Noble Truths briefly? I mean, I think we've been kind of dancing around it. I think it'd be good for our listeners, particularly those who don't know about what these Four Noble Truths are.
Okay, well, the Buddha started off with the fact that basically almost everybody is dissatisfied. That, you know, many people feel they would only be happy if... And very, very few people really have a very deep inner sense of contentment and satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're endlessly dissatisfied, always believing if only we had this, or if only that was different, or if only something, that somehow we would be happy. And so it's like, you know, I don't know, it's like chasing a rainbow. You know, you never can touch it. And so the Buddha said, well, why? Why? Do we want to be happy, but we're not happy? We spend so much time and trouble and effort and money on bringing happiness, but still it's elusive. What's the source of our discontent? What's the source of our suffering? And he said that the source of our suffering is our clinging mind, the fact that we hold on to things, that we solidify things, and we solidify people, and we don't hold things gently and lightly, but we grasp at them, thinking that our happiness depends on keeping things just the way they are and not accepting the fact that everything is impermanent, everything is in a state of flow. But, of course, the Buddha also said there is a way out of this. There is a state beyond that, that this, although this is how we are all trapped, we don't need to be trapped. We can get out of this. There is a state beyond that. There is the unconditioned, beyond the conditioned. And then the fourth noble truth, of course, is the Eightfold Path, which includes our ethical, physical conduct, our speech, and our mind.
Mm-hmm.
So he laid out a path for us to gradually begin to let go.
Now, In chapter 2 of the book that I've been reading, Reflections on a Mountain Lake, this is by Tenzin Palmo, you speak about three basic motivations for practicing Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
They remind me of the core essence of the Eightfold Noble Path in a way, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one is the realization that something in our life isn't quite the way we want it. We have many of these experiences. This is, again, where our attachments and our addictions to having it a certain way come into play. In your case, you were in a flooded cave, and you realized that seeking something besides wetness at the time wasn't going to make you happy. You know? So speak about this... you know, this stepping on, and what Dharma is, if you would, practicing the Dharma with these basic motivations. Speak about what Dharma actually is in the Buddhist tradition. And, you know, some people are living dharmic lives without necessarily even being a Buddhist, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And most Buddhists are leading non-dharmic lives while thinking that they're perfect practitioners.
So there's a point where, you know, things aren't working. I mean, everybody has those in their lives.
Yes, but then, you know, if we look at our lives and we see that things are not the way we would like them to be, to realize that maybe the problem isn't out there with other people and other situations, but since we cannot change everything out there to conform to our ideals, then maybe the quickest, easiest, simplest way is to change our perception and our ideals.
All right, so
that's what the Dharma is about. I mean, Dharma, first of all, means the way things really are and not the way we normally perceive them to be, which is very much perverts what is actually there. We see things as being very solid and very static when actually they're very flowing and totally impermanent, for example.
Okay, and so Dharma translated is the way.
Yes. So it's also not only is it the goal, but it's also the path leading to the goal.
Path leading to the goal. Let's, if you will, join me for one more conversation segment. We'll take a break here, and then we'll close out with Tenzin Palmo and our discussion of her teachings out of her book that I've mentioned a number of times, Reflections on a Mountain Lake. We'll be back.